I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. China says it has a problem. Too many of its young people are hooked on playing video games to the exclusion of everything else in their lives. Chinese doctors have declared internet addiction a disease, and they've established treatment centers that combine boot camp techniques with talk therapy. Our guest, Hila Madalia, co-directed Web Junkie for POV that airs tonight on PBS, including WHYY TV 12 at 10 o'clock. The documentary takes viewers inside a rehab center near Beijing as patients and their families struggle with the effects of obsessive gaming. Our guest, Hila Madalia, is a George Foster Peabody Award-winning director and producer. She's been nominated for 3 Emmys and joins us from Israel. Hila Madalia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Nice to be on.
How were you able to get access inside of this center where you filmed? I know the Chinese are not often very open to having outsiders come in and take a look at their country.
Sure. So actually, Shosh Lam, who co-directed the documentary with me, she saw a report on the Australian television that one of the kids was beaten to death in one of those camps. And, she brought the story to me. We thought it's amazing. Then she went to China to try to look for the camp. And then the first, it took a few trips of her there till we actually, she managed to meet with Professor Tao. And actually we got him to open the door for us and allow us to film the documentary. And, you know, it's important to say that actually we never got a government permission. We actually didn't even ask for one because there was the center is located on the military base. Mm-hmm. So there was no way we were going to get it. So we really, it's Professor Tao who opened the door for us and let us film there.
And Professor Tao, he's the head of this center, and he talked about this addiction as they see this in China. He described it as electronic heroin.
Right. Yes, he actually, Professor Tao, he is a psychiatrist in the military hospital of Beijing, and he was specialized in addiction, substance addiction, and even since 2005 or 2004, he started to specialize in internet addiction. And he really says that what the internet does to your head is very similar in all the tests that he does to what drug and alcohol addiction does.
We see some of the young people playing video games. I have to say they look very familiar. Looks like the kinds of video games you see in this country. Also, we see them at internet cafes. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the kids in China play the exact same games that the American kids are playing, like World of Warcraft. Not only they are the same games, but actually those are social games. So often they play with kids in America.
How did you, number of the I guess you call them patients, I'm not sure what you call them, but they were in this rehab center. A number of them described basically being tricked by their parents to come to the center. Some of them sounded like they were almost kidnapped and brought to this center. How did they end up there?
Right. So it's exactly right what you described. So basically most of the kids, almost all of them were tricked. For example, like Nikki, one of the kids that's in the film, his parents told him he's going to a ski vacation in Russia and has a connecting flight in Beijing. And then he found himself, this is how they brought him to the center. Some kids are actually being drugged by their parents. And the next thing they're, waking up behind bars in the centers. You know, but it's really important for me to also explain that, there is no doubt that these kids have problems. They drop out of school. They lose their interpersonal communication skills. They play day and night. Some of them even wear diapers to not lose a precious moment of game. So the parents, when they're bringing their kids to the center, they're very desperate. You know, this is in many ways their last resort. So it's important to remember that. So, of course, it's China, like in America or in Europe or in Israel. If a parent would do something like that to a child, the child could potentially even sue him, to drug the child and bring him to a rehab center like that. But But, you know, the parents really want to help their kids, and they don't know what to do.
Well, and there are a number of scenes of the young people in therapeutic sessions, also some of the parents, some family therapy sessions, I would say. And it looks like a place where it's a mix of kind of boot camp and marching and exercises. But there is talk therapy going on here. And I actually thought some of the talk therapy was pretty interesting. I thought it was also insightful in many kinds of ways. What is the sort of – is it sort of trying to cover all the bases at this treatment center?
I mean, the course of treatment includes, as you said, like a boot camp, a kind of a little tough training. It includes a therapy in smaller group for the kids and smaller group for the parents, and kind of more like a lecture for the – like a big group, like a basically lecture to everybody, sometimes only for – all the kids, and sometimes the kids and their parents. And those lectures are really kind of a re-education, a little bit kind of brainwash session. And then when there are issues, there are family therapy, like basically the kids and their parents alone at times. And the other thing that the kids are, a lot of them are getting antidepressive pills.
Well,
and medication.
Yes, and one of them, a guy whose name is Hope, or described as Hope in this documentary, is put in isolation for 10 days. This is after running away, essentially escaping from the facility. How common is that? And how extreme, I guess, is the isolation?
Yeah, I mean, they do it. It's very hard for the kids. They believe it's some kind of it's actually a Japanese technique. For us, it's very harsh to see, but it's, you know, they believe it gives them like a possibility to really reflect and to think and to kind of think of what they did and what they went through. It's very hard. So for the first few days, they don't even allow them to have a pen or a paper. And after a couple of days, they give them a pen and a paper so they can write their thoughts and feelings. And, you know, again, For Western eyes, everything that is happening there, or a lot of the things that are happening there, are very harsh. But, you know, one of the things we kept telling ourselves is that, you know, first of all, of course, there is a problem. And the second of all, you know, we're trying not to be judgmental, but actually to look and to learn and to more observe than to judge them for what they do.
There was one young man named Nikki who, frankly, through pretty much this whole documentary, is expressionless. I mean, I'm not saying he is drugged, but he has this drugged look about him. His mother is in tears in one of these sessions. He talks about his loneliness, that the computer is really the only thing that he feels this connection to. He says to his parents, "You don't care about me." And at one point, there's this violent outburst. His father actually cries. But one gets the sense that, and I have to say, over the weekend, I was thinking about Nikki, like, what is he doing today? How is he doing today? But it tapped into the kind of loneliness that seems to be at issue here for so many of these young people.
You know, one of the most amazing things that Nikki says in the film, there are two things that I really connect to what he said. One is that he said when he feels lonely, he goes to the computer, and then he finds another lonely person on the other side.
Yes.
And I think that's very reflective, you know, in this day and time, you know, we're always connected, we are always online, everybody's always available, but at the same time, we are more alone. You know, and we are connect less and less with people, and you can see it, of course, on the younger kids, how they, you know, they're always texting and they're not talking as much on the phone, I think, as, I mean, my daughter is two, but I remember me being a teenager, I was always on the phone, and I think now kids are always texting. So really one of the questions that we keep asking ourselves is, you know, whether it's a social phenomena or an addiction, and also whether an addiction could be, a social phenomena could be an addiction.
And that's something, yeah, and that's
something very
sure, and something we're going to pick up a little bit later in the show. Another issue that seemed to also be part of these sessions is this focus on school, on studying. At one point, I think one of the young people there says, you know, the only thing that matters is how well I do in school. And perhaps to the exclusion or detriment of other parts of family life.
You know, the Chinese society is very, puts a lot of pressure on the kids to really excel in school. They, I mean, in many ways, you know, being a one child, you have your parents, you have your grandparents, everybody is really depending on you and pushing you. And in many cases, the parents really telling their kids over and over again, you know, you've got to study, don't do anything at home. And the system is also very, very stressing. Mm-hmm. It's like there is some kind of a ranking system within the school that is very challenging for the children. So they feel a lot of pressure, you know. Anyway, this is actually one of the reasons that Professor Tao says that phenomena is so extreme, you know, that because of all this pressure, they find the internet as the escape for them, you know. And I think that when we screened the film in the United States, in Sundance and in other places, you know, we actually met people who told us that their son or daughter suffer from internet addiction. And you know, it's definitely a global phenomenon, but also, you know, China, it's more extreme there. Yes, there is a lot of reflection and a lot of things that are very similar.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you. So does this approach work? Does it break this addiction as it's been described in China?
You know, Tao claims 70% success. Of course, we have no way to check it. But, you know, we are in touch, of course, with the kids in our film, and you know, some of them, like for example, Hacker is going to the university now. We study art and Chinese calligraphy. You know, Nikki had more troubles when he left the center. So, you know, it depends. I would say that the one challenge with internet addiction is that, unlike drug or substance addiction, is that you can't really. You know, we need the internet in our lives. We need it for school. We need it for work. So the challenge, both in China and in the West, is, you know, even if you go through treatment and, you know, you really have to learn to still use the internet and still use technology and still, you know, be online and at the same time learn how to moderate it so you don't stop function and you do everything you have to do.
And again, something else we'll be discussing with our other two guests. Hila Madalia, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. George Foster Peabody, award-winning director and producer, co-director of this this documentary called Web Junkie. And again, it airs tonight on TV12 at 10 o'clock, part of the POV series. As I said, we have two guests waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about how much screen time is too much screen time. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We were just talking about a documentary, Web Junkie, about a rehab center in China that treats internet addiction as a disease. Well, what about the United States? How much do we know about the health effects of screen use or overuse? How much video game playing is too much? And we have two guests who have joined us. Patrick Markey is here with us in our Philadelphia studio, professor of psychology, also the director of the Interpersonal Research Laboratory at Villanova University. And much of his research has examine the positive and negative effects of video games. And Patrick Markey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Mark Potenza. He's a professor of psychiatry, child study, and neurobiology at the Yale School of Medicine, also senior research scientist at Casa Columbia, director of Yale Center for Excellence in Gambling Research. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Mark, let me begin with you. And we were talking about this program in China that treats obsessive use of the internet or of gaming as an addiction. Should we think of this as an addiction if someone is playing, you know, 10 hours a day, every single day, they wear diapers so they don't have to run to the bathroom? Is that the sign of an addiction?
It's a very good question. I think that the extent to which internet use can be considered as an addiction has been debated. People have defined some of the core elements of addiction as diminished control over behavior, continued engagement in a behavior despite adverse consequences, as well as having an urge or a craving to engage in the behavior. And if we look at internet use, I think that there are people who can experience these types of feelings or behaviors and may be classified as having an internet addiction.
I mean, it's interesting to think about addiction in terms of behavior versus substance. I mean, we talk about an addiction to alcohol or an addiction to drugs. I don't know if we're talking about behavior, we're also talking about things like shopping. But if, you know, today we're focusing in on the internet, is it important to distinguish between substance and behavior?
I think that it is very important to think about the similarities and differences. And this was a major question, has been a major question over the past 10 years or so, particularly with respect to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So this is the book that is the nomenclature. It has all the listings of psychiatric disorders. It's generated by the American Psychiatric Association, and they released its fifth edition in 2013. And they reclassified what was in the fourth edition, the disorder pathological gambling. They renamed it as gambling disorder in order to diminish the stigma associated with the name. And they reclassified it together with substance use disorders into a substance-related and addictive disorders. So there's now a precedent for thinking about behaviors like excessive and interfering and problematic forms of gambling together with substance use disorders.
Well, Patrick, let me get you in on the conversation. I know you saw this documentary, and I don't want to make the whole show about it, but nonetheless, what we see are generally young men, you know, some of them playing hours and hours and hours of video games, 10 hours a day. One of them bragged about 300 hours. I don't know if that's humanly possible, but the idea is that this was their entire life, and they were willing to give up most anything so they could play these video games.
Yeah, I mean, internet addiction is definitely a problem. The question really is, how big of a problem is it? And that's usually my bigger concern is, are we taking an issue that affects a very small group of people and making it a bigger concern? So when parents talk to me, they find I do research, they'll often say, oh, my kid's addicted to the internet, or as the director was saying, she was worried about text messaging and these kids nowadays. And very often they don't mean addiction. They mean they're just worried their kid plays too much. And one thing the research actually pretty clearly shows is that the amount of time people engage in media actually is not really related to adverse health outcomes, especially in males. It's such a normative behavior that it's basically normal for boys to engage in a lot of times. Now, again, that's not saying somebody could take it to the extreme. There's certainly the minority of individuals that go too far. And so we just have to be careful of where we use that word addiction and where we kind of are more irritated at our child's behavior.
But it seems to me if it's to the exclusion of everything else, of going to school, of having friends, of going to the bathroom, of eating.
Yes. I mean, that's definitely – for me, that's the gold standard of what defines when we get problematic behavior is it interfering with life. Now, with screen time and video games, we have to be careful because sometimes it's not the video games that are causing that problem. Rather, it's an underlying issue that's causing it. So it might be that there's an underlying issue causing a person to do poorly perhaps in school and play lots of video games. Perhaps they're very impulsive. And so we have to be very careful. Sometimes it's not what we think of as the addiction that's actually causing these issues.
And there is a social – or there can be a social part of playing video games, even obsessively.
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of the – when we look at why do people play video games, we look at needs. And one of the needs that video games fulfill, especially in this context, is a kind of a need of belongingness. It makes people feel closer. And we think about relationships, there's kind of two types of relationships. There's strong relationships that we have with our friends and family. These are very close. And media can help those. They can help us. We can come home from school. We might text our friends, say, hey, meet up with me. Or if we're alone, we might play a game with them virtually. Then there's also weak relationships, and those are kind of the more relationships that you might have online where they're very superficial and so forth. Now, sometimes those turn into strong relationships, but very often they maintain that. And the problem is if that's all you have. Now, the other thing to remember, though, is many people, and we saw this in the documentary, report they don't have these relationships in the real world. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, the media might be the only way they're getting it. So it's not as if they're losing relationships because they turn to the media. And in fact, instead, the media might be giving them these weak relationships as opposed to no relationships.
Where maybe in the so-called real world or the analog world, it's hard for them to have some kind of a deep connection, but they can get some kind of a connection online.
Yeah, and we find people who are lonely do tend to have problematic behaviors. And that's it's probably not because those problematic behaviors are causing loneliness. It's probably because that loneliness is causing those problematic behaviors. Now, of course, the problem is, does that become a cycle? Or does a person learn how to interact better? In some ways, these online interactions, you're having a person who's not normally used to interacting with people. At least they're practicing in kind of a superficial way, granted. But there's a possibility that might be able to transform into real-world interactions.
Let me go back to Mark Potenza. And I don't know if you saw this documentary or not, but it is clear that there's a kind of pervasive loneliness that these young people feel. And perhaps even that the parents feel a kind of loneliness within these one-child families. If we're talking about either addiction or sort of obsessive use of the internet or of video games, is there an emotional factor like loneliness?
I think that's a very important point, and it's not limited to China. I think that one of the findings across studies from the United States, Europe, and Asia – amongst other places, is that problematic internet use is associated with depression and depressive features. So I think that the idea that being lonely or depressed may promote problematic engagement in internet use or types of internet use is something that should be looked at closely.
But which comes first? I mean, is the loneliness as a result of isolating yourself playing these games, or is it the loneliness that allows a young person to find some kind of connection through games?
I think that's a great question and would be best addressed through longitudinal studies where we follow groups of people over time and look directly at that question. However, most studies to date have been cross-sectional in nature. So right now we don't fully understand whether problematic internet use leads to increased depression, depression leads to problematic internet use, or there's some common factor that may lead to both.
And what do you think about the idea that Patrick talked about, which is for some people that maybe have trouble relating in the analog world, that the internet might be a good place to practice certain behaviors or to feel more comfortable relating to people that you don't have to make eye contact with, for instance?
I think that's a great point. I think it's important for us to look at both the positive and negative aspects of digital technologies and internet use and to look at the potential to promote health. And I think digital technologies offer a substantial potential for promoting health.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mark Potenza. He's a professor of psychiatry, child study, and neurobiology at the Yale School of Medicine and joins us along with Patrick Markey. He's a professor of psychology, also the director of the Interpersonal Research Laboratory that's at Villanova University. And we are talking about the effect of screen time, of internet playing on developing minds, why some young people love to play video games almost to the exclusion of everything else. And how do you find that balance, I guess, between the internet and other activities that you can engage in? To join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Patrick, we were talking about before the show began, and I said, do you play video games? And you had a, you answered my question, but you had a bit of a look on your face.
Oh, you're outing me on the air.
I'm outing you on the air.
Goodness.
Only because this is important. No. This is important.
No.
We need to understand what we're really talking about.
Yeah.
Here.
Actually, I think my answer to you is I do play video games, and I said it very embarrassingly. And the reason why I think one of the reasons why people get so concerned about video games is actually because of my embarrassment in some ways. The reason why I'm embarrassed is because there's a disconnect. In society, we tend to go through these things called moral panics, in which we look for kind of like folk devils, things like in the 50s as rock and roll music and then comic books.
Right,
exactly.
I remember that.
And so now it's probably video games. And it's really defined by mostly a generational gap. So you have generally older people who did not grow up around this technology, who don't see much use in it. And then mostly younger people who have been surrounded by it, who love it, who enjoy it. And it's really easy for the one group to blame all the ills on the other group. And that
older generations are notorious for, right, you know, worrying about the,
yeah,
next generation.
Yeah, and every generation does it. So it's not unique to this older generation. I mean, it'll happen next and so forth. And I think that's actually why it gets blown – a lot of the concern about internet addiction gets blown out of proportion. It's this misunderstanding of technology. And that's partially my embarrassment, that one of the ways that, for example, in the past, some people have tried to take – and this is probably the best way, as Mark is saying, that to take the gambling paradigm and to apply it to internet addiction. And so some people will reward questions on questionnaires to fit. And one of the questions that sometimes get used is, do you lie about gambling? And it might make sense to lie about gambling. It might be an indicator of addiction, right? I don't go to the casino all that time. But video games, it might mean something else. So, for example, I mean, I'm a single guy. If I'm going out on a date, I'm going to tell the person I'm with, like, yeah, I don't play video games, just because I'm well aware that it's not societally appropriate for a professor to play video games. And so it's not a sign of addiction as much as a sign of just kind of a disconnect between groups of people.
I think that's actually quite fascinating and illuminating, and I didn't mean to out you on the air, but I thought it was such an important thing to be part of our conversation. Mark, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
Sure. I'd be happy to talk about my video gaming
background,
if that would be helpful.
No, that would be very helpful, actually. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I have done video gaming on a console with my son, and we find it as a means to interact. I have not done internet gaming, but that may reflect my my older generation-ness.
Feels like we're on thin ice here. No. But Mark, is it finding that balance? I mean, obviously, if someone is not going to school and they're playing video games as well, that it seems to me that would be some kind of a red flag. But if you can talk to people and sit around the Thanksgiving table without having to have a screen next to you, I mean, is it finding that balance?
I think that's a very important point. I think finding the balance is extremely important. I think that the core feature of an addiction when it becomes problematic is it interfering significantly in major areas of life functioning. And different people may see that with different clarity at different points in their lives. And I think it's important to look at this from a developmental perspective, both from the positive and negative aspects, in that we don't know the extent to which digital technologies or specific aspects of digital technologies or the extent to which people are using digital technologies may influence development in a good or a bad way. Mm. And we should be mindful that people mature and they may grow out of certain behaviors like gaming. But we should also be mindful that it may impact one's development and alter the course of development in either a good or a bad way.
Patrick, I was out to dinner a couple of weeks ago and saw a family with two young kids. Everyone was on their device, but I thought, I wasn't sure what to make of it exactly, and the kids were little. I mean, they were preschool age. Each of them had their own screen. One of them had headphones on. And maybe that's the way to go out to dinner. I'm trying not to judge. But it I guess it does raise some questions, and perhaps because I'm of that older generation, I didn't grow up with this stuff.
Right.
So you see this and you think, gosh, what is the impact going to be? And what is the effect of that?
And even if it doesn't have – I mean, I'm pretty much in the camp that it's – if they went to dinner and they did this, it's not going to have a long-term impact, that they're going to grow up, love their parents and all that stuff. But that doesn't discount that it might not be a great behavior to do in the now, that we don't just have to worry about predicting the future, that enjoying a dinner with your family might be a very important behavior to do right now. And so that might be reason enough to – not allow devices at the table. So again, just because we – like, for example, I do have two kids, and I don't let them play at the table either. And again, it's not because I'm scared they're going to become addicted to the internet. It's simply because I want to enjoy that time with my children at the table. So it doesn't have to be an all or nothing kind of thing.
What do you think, Mark?
I very much agree. I think taking the dinner example, I think there's important social value. There's important familial value in having a dinner together as a family. And by not diverting one's attention to a device, I think one gains benefit in multiple domains.
We have an email from Hillary says, I play World of Warcraft. I know some people in their 60s and 70s who play as well. I've heard that gaming helps people learn to work with others. You go into the dungeons, raids, and battlegrounds, and you have to work together to get things done. Agreed, Patrick?
Yeah. I mean, there actually is evidence to suggest that cooperative video games like a World of Warcraft, where you're working with a team, actually does build kind of a camaraderie between people, that you develop friendships and closeness and things of that sort. This isn't like you're not going to drastically alter your personality and become extremely close to you. These effects are rather small. But there is some evidence to suggest that actually happens if it is a cooperative video game.
And we're almost up on a break here. Do you want to add anything to that, Mark?
I very much agree. And I think the example of comic books resonates with me as well, in that with Frederick Wertham and the congressional hearings in the 1950s, there was a big uproar that I think was overblown, and I think we should look at video games in a balanced fashion.
Well, we are talking about the internet, video games. What do we know about the health effects of screen use or overuse, especially on young minds? And that's Mark Potenza. He's a professor of psychiatry, child study, and neurobiology at the Yale School of Medicine. And with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Patrick Markey, professor of psychology, also the director of the Interpersonal Research Laboratory at Villanova University. And I see calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We want to hear from you, and you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about video games with Patrick Markey and also with Mark Potenza. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Dustin from, looks like, Princeton, New Jersey to join us. And Dustin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Love the show.
Thank you.
I think this is a great topic. I feel like I should preface this by saying I'm 46 years old. I grew up during the height of the arcade video game time frame, so I'm not one of those older generations that, you know, thinks this is like rock and roll music and comic books. But I have a newly teenaged son, and I think that one of the issues that video games has given him, potentially, is sort of finding happiness in boredom. And so if he doesn't have any friends that are outside playing and he's used up his video game time for the day, there's no creativity, it seems, of just like walking into a playroom or the basement or the garage and just finding something else to do. That seems to be the difficulty that I've seen the kids on the block. If they're alone, they're kind of out of ideas. And it's almost like the video games are too easy a default to go to for entertainment.
Well, that's fascinating, Dustin, and I'm sure you're not alone, and I'd be curious what our guests have to say. Patrick, if I can start with you, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I mean, my first concern would be, is it that he's bored of video games or is that he's just a teenager? I mean, when we were 14, it might have been difficult thinking back, I might have had trouble finding things to do as well. Certainly, it's not a sign of addiction that he can't find anything to do. But again, it would be the balance issue of making sure that you're able to do activities beyond just video games, that you understand how to do other things. But it's hard to know exactly what that one behavior would mean.
What are your thoughts, Mark?
Well, I think that it raises a large question, particularly from a developmental perspective, about introducing digital devices to young children and the extent to which they will tolerate boredom versus expect immediate gratification. And I think that's something that we should be looking at because I don't think we have the answers to that question.
And I think the American Academy of Pediatrics, you know, talks about especially when children are young, limiting their screen time and, I guess, what, expanding it as a child gets older, Mark?
I think that sounds very reasonable, and I think it resonates with the topic of setting limits on certain times and extents of use, particularly with respect to the example of having meals together, but also in other domains.
Patrick, you looked at violent video mm-hmm. games to sort of see what their effect is. This is a very hot topic. Do we have definitive conclusions?
Oh, my goodness, no. Holy cow.
No. But what do we have?
We have a lot of confusion. What the majority of research, when you kind of look at all the research, sit back and blur your eyes, it tends to suggest that violent video games might have a very short-term effect on our change in hostility and aggression. Very short-term, though. It's much more akin to like a movie. If you see a really sad movie, you're going to be really sad right afterward. The bigger issue, though, that most people are concerned about is what's the long-term effect? And more importantly, what does it relate to violence? I mean, that's usually, in the context of video games, unfortunately, violence, we're usually talking about school shootings, homicides, and things of that sort. And there's really no evidence to suggest that it's related to those severe acts of violence. In fact, the data actually suggests, if anything, it's actually the opposite, that it's children who play an average number of violent video games as their peers do tend not to have that extreme violent behavior. It's people that deviate in the direction of not playing as many violent video games. Huh. And so we have to be very careful. So yes, they could be bad in the very short term, but just like I said, like how a movie might make us feel bad, but relating it to anything extreme is going well beyond the data at this point.
But looking at that short term, if someone is, played a violent video game, are they more likely, even in the short term, to feel angry, to punch their younger brother or something like that?
No. We don't have anything in research. I mean, our research studies, and again, this is where I do research. I can be very critical of myself and my peers, that when we study these kind of aggressive outcomes, we're looking at things like, do they say they're angry afterward? Do they give a person hot sauce that doesn't like hot sauce? Do they blast a person with kind of irritating noise? That they're these very mundane forms of aggression that we're looking at in the laboratory.
Right.
And so to generalize from those to punching a brother or anything like that, it's too extreme. In fact, we can almost guarantee it's not related to it, because in our laboratory and across the country, we've done thousands of subjects have been run through these studies where they are exposed to violent video games or not. And we've never had one case where a subject has suddenly punched a research assistant or punched another subject. So in a weird way, we've done this study, and it just doesn't happen in the short-term effects.
Hard to study this, Mark Potenza?
Yeah, I think that it is challenging to study, and there may be important individual differences to consider as well. So we have conducted some high school survey studies, and we found that video gaming was a normative behavior for boys and was not associated with any negative health measures. But for girls, only about 30% of girls were video gaming, and there were associations between video gaming and measures of aggression like carrying a weapon or getting into physical fights. So I think it's important to look at the data dispassionately. Again, cross-sectional, we don't know if, for example, a certain group of individuals were drawn to play the video games versus the video games led to something or some other possibility. But I think gathering that information and trying to understand it better will be important from a public health perspective.
Did you just say that the effect of violent video games when girls play it, that it actually affects their behavior more than boys? Did you say that?
Well, no. I think what we found was an association, and it resonated with some data that were described in a book called Grand Theft Childhood, which did focus group work where they found that girls who were playing video games seemed to have more aggressive tendencies. Hmm. Again, I think it's an area that we don't fully understand at this point in time. And I think it's important for us to look at the individual difference factors that may relate to some of these behaviors.
Patrick, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to point out, too, is I believe the study that Mark's talking about, his study, looked at just video gaming in general, not violent video games.
And correct.
And so it's hard to know what that would mean. And so it's really children or girls, I should say, who do something that's not a normative behavior for the group are more aggressive. Might be an easier way to interpret it. And so we just have to be cautious in, like I said, drawing too many conclusions from – and is, Mark's very cautious about it with cross-sectional data.
Right.
In the laboratory, when there are experiments done on violence, we tend not to find gender has a – alters the effect. Males tend to be more aggressive in general, but the effect tends not to be greater for males than it does for females in a laboratory setting.
Let me see what Catherine from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Good to talk to you. I have a question.
Sure.
I have a son who's 20 years old. I am 58 years old. We had him late in life and went through a divorce and everything, and I've been away from him for 5 years. And while he was in high school, first he's had a Game Boy in his hand since the age of five, and it started with Pokemon, and he beat all of those games. When he was in high school, his dad always had, like, a timer control on it so that he would not play more than, like, 4 or 5 hours a day, or weekends it was extended or whatever. But he always got a good night's sleep. He dropped out of college with depression, and he was also, well, let me just say, during the high school years, he was in World of Warcraft. And I was proud of him because he became a leader. And, you know, like you said, people that play these games look for, you know, the attention. And he went from World of Warcraft to League of Legends. Now, he plays this game 10 to 12 hours a day, and he hates his parents because we can't wrap our heads around this, because his biggest dream is to be a competitive gamer. And I know you need sponsors for that. I think my question is this. Is it realistic to let him go another year of playing 10 to 12 hours to meet his dream goal?
Catherine, let me see what Patrick Markey has to say, and then also I'd like to hear from Mark Potenza. And obviously, Catherine, we don't know all the details of your family. You talk about the fact that there was a divorce and that
right.
You were away from him for something like 5 years until recently. So these are factors that we really can't necessarily understand.
Yeah, I mean,
completely.
Is it possible to give a suggestion for a specific case? But, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is becoming a professional gamer is an extremely low probability that a person will achieve that goal. I mean, it's actually harder to become a professional gamer than it would be to become like a NBA all-star. So a person, you know, if my son wanted to become an NBA all-star, that's great. But if he or she was practicing for 12 hours a day at the expense of everything else, I would probably try to move them in a different direction, just because I understand that it's probably not going to happen, just because it's such a rare, you know, a career to be able to have.
What do you think, Mark?
Oh, I very much agree. And I, you know, when I was younger, I was hopeful of being a professional baseball player. But my father at the age of 9 or 10 told me the odds of that were very low, and encouraged me to focus on my studies. And that was, a helpful thing, even though painful at the age of 8 or 9 to hear that.
Sure. hear from Catherine is some frustration, some worry, maybe a little bit of anger as well. I mean, you know, 10 to 12 hours a day and dropping out of school, it seems to me those are worrisome things.
I very much agree, and I think the history of depression is also another factor that one should throw into that mix of concerning elements. And my hope would be that he would be amenable to talking with a mental health professional, and that you would as well.
Indeed. Catherine, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and good luck to you and your son as well. Let me see what Eli from Philadelphia has to say. Eli, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm 25 years old. I grew up playing video games, and a lot of them were extremely educational. I learned a lot about
history, mathematics, spelling, even some basic physics. And I'm actually a third-year teacher now, teaching elementary and middle school-age kids. And I've noticed there really seems to be a lack of that kind of gaming being made nowadays. And I'm curious if guests have any perspective about that field and if there's a real push to move back towards the kind of games that I came up with in the 90s, in the early 2000s. Because it seems like, you know, integrating technology into the classroom is a huge push in modern education reform, and I'm just sort of have been surprised at how little there seems to be.
And Eli, I'm just curious, what were you playing back in the 90s?
I played Age of Empires, taught me about history. There is a great company called The Learning Company that seems to be sort of a shell of its former self that made games like Gizmos and Gadgets and Dr. Brain, things like that, that really taught me a lot about science and math.
Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, well, there still are games like that. I mean, I learned educational games even I'm older than you are, and I remember playing Oregon Trail and learning what dysentery was and all that stuff from those games.
Absolutely, he says, yeah.
And they still make educational games. I mean, in fact, a lot of them can be found on iPhones and iPads, which is actually for children, that's their go-to medium. Again, we talked about in the restaurant seeing people with iPhones, and it's because children play them. And there's tons of educational games out there. Now, certainly they're hidden a lot by the more mainstream games, which are not educational, which are more popular. But there are still some popular games. I mean, like Civilization is still a game, SimCity. I mean, so there are these games that are kind of educational in a way. But they're certainly out there. But you have to look through kind of all the other software to find them.
Eli, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mark, I think like a lot of people, my phone goes off and I'm all excited. Someone actually wants to talk to me or send me a text message. How much of this is just, you know, our reward center in our brain just getting activated by all this input from our gadgets?
It's a good question, and that's an area that we still don't fully understand. People are beginning to look at how people respond in general to internet-related stimuli and how people with problematic internet use may respond to these stimuli. Mm. And I think it's reasonable to expect that different people will find it rewarding depending on the type of stimulus that's being presented. Some people may have an aversive response if they want not to be disturbed, for example.
Or be found. An email from Cheryl says, I worry what the amount of time spent outdoors in nature is being drastically reduced because of video games and the internet.
Yeah, I mean, it might be. I mean, one thing that actually is interesting is sometimes when parents have cut back on internet, rather be through a school program or something like that, we actually find that the children still stay pretty sedentary. It's not like when you take it away, they suddenly go run outside and play tag, as we all might want our children to do. So very often it's just that children who don't move around a lot, who want to be inside, they play the internet. And also, this also gets into the generational difference. Certainly, going outside is great. I'm all for going outside, but maybe staying inside and going into a virtual world is not so bad. That it's not necessarily like one is good and one is bad. They're just different. And again, as parents who grew up playing tag, we might want our children to do that just because we don't understand the virtual world. But it might not necessarily be a bad thing.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. Patrick Markey, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sorry I outed you. Professor of Psychology, Director of the Interpersonal Research Laboratory at Villanova University. Mark Potenza, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's also the director of Yale's Center for Excellence in Gambling Research and also Yale's Program for Research on Impulsivity and Impulse Control Disorders. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Claire Moran, our summer intern. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.